The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and start spreading the news. New York, New York.
Running for the Senate in New York and then serving as your senator for 8 years was one of the greatest honors of my life.
But I am very proud that I was born here in New York City.
Bernie is the only politician, honestly, that comes out with the truth. He doesn't care. He has no ties to nobody. He just keeps it completely blunt.
I like her experience and her resume, and I feel confident that she could do an amazing job running the country.
He's opposed to fracking, and he will do whatever he can. I will trust and believe.
I don't think that he's strong enough in his foreign policy.
It's a lot of lofty ideas, and he has no way to put them in action.
Like, I really doubt that Hillary Clinton would just show up in the back of a rally where there's unvetted crowds. Like, this was out of nowhere.
I like that she's going to work to continue the Affordable Care Act and hopefully expand it.
I respect Hillary. I would love to vote for a woman as president. I do not respect the decisions she's made.
She's currently the most qualified to be running at all. I mean, it's not much competition for her.
She gives a lot of ammunition to the right.
There's that whole Bernie or bust movement, and they don't really have a reason not to like Hillary, but they like Bernie so much that they aren't just naturally against her.
Whoever wins the nomination will probably get my vote.
We've got to unite. When this primary contest is over, we've got to unite and make sure we have a Democrat in the White House in January.
Let's win in New York.
We will add to our vote total.
Let's take this fight to the White House.
We will win the nomination and then go on to the general election. Thank you all.
Some very excited voters there, courtesy of our partner station WNYC. And the candidates are coming. The candidates are here. There's Hillary Clinton at the Apollo, Bernie Sanders in the South Bronx. Some excited voters all over the state. A Quinnipiac University poll released Thursday showed Hillary Clinton leading over Bernie Sanders 54-42% in the Empire State, where it's kind of win or go home for Bernie Sanders. Brian Lehr is host of WNYC's The Brian Lehr Show. He's been following New York politics and talking to New York voters, Republican and Democrat, for a long, long time. He's with me now in the studio. Welcome, Brian. Hello.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
You're wearing your stethoscope, which gives you exactly the sound of the pulse of New York voters, right? What's going on?
Well, let me do a little more of the geography that you hinted at of where they've been campaigning the last few days. Clinton held rallies in the city and the suburbs at the famous Apollo Theater in Harlem, like you said. High turnout among black voters helps her. And she rallied yesterday in that upscale suburb aptly named Purchase, New York, just north of the city. The 1% definitely lives there in concentrations higher than 1%. But the site for that rally was also the State University campus in Purchase. Good optics as she tries to challenge Sanders for his young base. And Sanders' first big rally here, as you noted, was at an interesting location, a park in the South Bronx, St. Mary's Park, that most upscale New Yorkers probably never heard of, no less have ever gone to that neighborhood. That was to lay down a marker for the TV cameras, I think, showing a much more diverse audience than viewers have seen before in, say, Safeco Field in Seattle, where he had that big rally last week that was televised. About a third of the Democratic primary voters in New York State are expected to be black and Latino. So the geography of where they've chosen to campaign in their first few days in New York is very telling.
Does hometown boy give Bernie Sanders any creds here?
Well, they're both hometown candidates in their ways, and they're jockeying for position for that mantle. Bernie Sanders sounds more like the New Yorker in his delivery. Hillary Clinton sounds like the Illinois girl that she grew up being, but Sanders hasn't lived here since he moved to Vermont in the 1960s. Hillary Clinton, of course, represented the state in the U.S. Senate for two terms starting in with her election in the year 2000. So they both have different kinds of New York cred.
You've talked to voters. Is there excitement that the campaign comes to town for the first time in more than a decade?
Yeah, there is. I think people are kind of juiced, and it's hard to get people juiced in New York.
Yeah,
because they can go out and see any kind of event on any kind of day practically. But it has been a long time since a presidential primary of any kind was meaningful here. There are real Bernie loyalists here. We certainly saw it at that rally in the Bronx last night, which overflowed the park. There are certainly Clinton loyalists here. We saw it at the Apollo Theater, where she was visibly moved by some of the audience reaction to her. And New Yorkers are political animals in many, many cases. I think there are a lot of undecided people still.
I think New York also has a history of shutting down insurgent candidacies, particularly within the Democratic Party. We noted at the top of the hour that 88 New York primary shut down Jesse Jackson's bid for the presidential. He was actually a front runner for a very brief period in 1988. In 1992, Jerry Brown looked like maybe he was an alternative to Clinton in the mainstream, and the New York primary said, "No way, Jerry, see you later." You know, that would suggest that New York will tell Bernie to go bye-bye.
You think, but there's an interesting recent parallel with the election of New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Even though he's a Clinton supporter in the primary, de Blasio himself is a Bernie Sanders-like figure in New York politics, with everything organized around fighting inequality. And he wasn't supposed to win the Democratic primary for mayor here in 2013. The heavy favorite going in was the New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, who would have been the city's first woman mayor and whose reputation was very competent, very experienced leader, but someone who had cut too many deals with the business sector for political expediency, as she was seen. Sound familiar? And de Blasio beat her by a lot. So New York voters can choose a Bernie-like underdog. And that Quinnipiac poll result that you cited at the top, 54% to 42%, which is a meaningful lead for Clinton, but that's closer than some might have predicted, considering her time here as a two-term U.S. senator. Very popular when she represented New York, elected and, reflected by large margins greater than 12 points at that time.
Now, you aspire to be a debate moderator if you can get these two candidates together via Twitter and have a radio debate, which, first of all, let me just say, should happen, and I absolutely endorse that. What's your mission as a moderator?
We have a little Twitter campaign going, first of all. If anybody knows me as a radio host and debate moderator and wants to support this mission, tweet at Hillary Clinton, at Bernie Sanders, at Democrats, and use the hashtag radio debate. So we would love to have them do a public radio debate on all the New York State public radio stations. I'd bring in some other people from those stations, and we would talk about the issues.
Well, let's talk about an issue that I'm wondering what you think. I mean, it seems like New York would be a place where Israel has come up again and again in the GOP debates. Curiously, Hillary has a very specific stand with Israel policy in her stump speech. Bernie Sanders has, in a sense, distanced himself from Israel in his approach to the Middle East. How would you approach that as a debate moderator?
Well, I would very likely ask that as one of the questions and bring out the differences that you refer to here. I've heard both there what they both said about Israel, and they really are different on this. If Trump is the one who's gotten the reputation of being neutral on Israel, trying to walk that line between being pro-Israel and neutral so he could negotiate between the Israelis and the Palestinians, it's really Bernie Sanders who most explicitly says there's right on both sides, there's wrong on both sides. I would like to get in there and try to help them work it out. But he's more explicitly supportive of the Palestinian cause in addition to the Israeli cause than probably any candidate in the race.
How has Trump's presence on the GOP side changed the New York primary for the Democrats and really made the GOP Republican primary interesting?
Well, he gives them all an easy target. Clinton says that Sanders didn't respond forcefully enough to Trump's abortion snafu the other day. You certainly can find Sanders' comments where he did. Maybe his first one was to try to write it off as a distraction from the real issues, which he says a lot about a lot of these, you know, Trump media storms.
You're sympathetic with. I mean, you're sympathetic with that idea of like stop paying attention to the noise. Look at the signal.
Totally. And if I get to interview the Republican candidates as they come through, I'm going to try to get away from the noise and pin some of them down on their positions. But, you know, the Republican primary candidates are arriving here, too. John Kasich is the first one in the pool. He did a town hall in Queens and held a couple of news conferences in the city and more. The new Quinnipiac poll has Trump winning big in New York, 56% to about 20% each for Cruz and Kasich. But that poll was taken before Trump's troubles with fumbling the abortion question on MSNBC and his campaign manager getting criminally charged for alleged misdemeanor battery of a female journalist. And Ted Cruz breaking out to a lead now in Wisconsin. Trump is having probably the toughest media week of his campaign, and we'll see if he's at a turning point. But, you know, much of the Republican vote is in upstate New York, which is economically depressed in some places in the way of some hollowed-out industrial Midwest kinds of towns. And that's Trump country. You think of New York as having sophisticated, moderate Republicans like Nelson Rockefeller and George Pataki. But the Republican primary winner for governor here in 2010 was a businessman from the Buffalo area named Carl Palladino,
right,
who's very rough and tumble, kind of like, think downscale Donald Trump. So don't assume John Kasich can just walk in here because he sounds moderate.
Well, Brian Lehr, as I can hear just from the analysis you've given us already, that you should definitely moderate a debate if we can get these candidates together. What's the Twitter handle?
At Democrats, at Hillary Clinton, at Bernie Sanders, so they see it. And the hashtag is Radio Debate.
Brian Lehr, host of The Brian Lehr Show on WNYC. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, John.
Hey, sports fans, your baseball's back. Coming up, we'll look at the boom in the number of home runs. What marks the new season for you, Orlando, Florida? The nice yellow layer of pollen my car gets. Luckily, I don't suffer from allergies.
This is Karen from Rhode Island. The start of the new baseball season means that maybe the Red Sox will be contenders this year.
Hi, this is Carissa. I live in Oklahoma, and spring here is announced by the winds blowing in a different set of allergies and tornadoes. It also brings a whole new set of amazing sunsets, though.
Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, crocuses, snowdrops, daffodils, and the warmer breeze. Spring will be in full swing when I can smell the earth. Comment, tell your story at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Every once in a while, a book comes along that is so starkly clear and deeply relevant, you just know that the people who most need to read it probably won't. I speak of the new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, by military historian Andrew Bacevich. Since the waning days of the Cold War, the tantalizing brass ring for the White House has clearly been achieving Middle East peace. Jimmy Carter nearly got a Nobel Peace Prize for the Camp David peace agreement between Israel and Egypt, and every president since Carter has been drawn into the region. Iraq, Somalia, Beirut, Afghanistan, Syria. Even the current presidential candidates are anxious to discuss new missions against ISIS. What has it all achieved? Was it all a waste? This is a very sensitive subject for all the soldiers who fought these wars, even for someone who was part of an obviously failed mission that went bad. All 19 of his buddies died in a Taliban ambush, but Marcus Luttrell, a Navy SEAL, miraculously survived. His story, The Lone Survivor became a movie, and here is CNN journalist Jake Tapper posing that sensitive question to Navy SEAL Marcus Luttrell and the actor who played him, Mark Wahlberg.
We spent our whole lives trained to defend this country, and then we were sent over there by this country. So you're telling me that because we were over there doing what we were told by our country that it was senseless and they died for nothing?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
That's what you said. So let me just say that, yeah, it went bad for us over there, but that was our job. That's what we did. We didn't complain about it. We went out there and did what we did best, and at the end of it, we weren't standing. They were.
That insistence on having done his job and Jake Tapper's awkward wonderment over what that job really was is the strategic question facing America today, according to Andrew Bacevich, who served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the U.S. Army. He's a former professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His book takes this painful question on profoundly, bravely, and clearly. America has failed miserably, he says, in the Middle East. In many ways, worse than in Vietnam. It's a devastating indictment by a man who loves his country and knows a thing or two about military strategy.
You know, I happen to be a Vietnam veteran, where, of course, we lost 58,000 soldiers in an utterly misguided war. And all these years later, the question, what did they die for, is a difficult one to answer. And it is easy for me to understand, as a Vietnam veteran, why there are many who do not wish to have that question even asked. It's too painful. And I think we are and will continue to be in much the same situation with regard to U.S. military involvement in the Islamic world. We haven't lost nearly as many Americans. But those that have died in Iraq or Afghanistan or Somalia or wherever, as the campaigns continue to proliferate, we are going to have to find the courage to ask ourselves, what did they die for? What have they died for? But one of the things about that story that troubles me the most personally is that I can see no end in sight, that there is this astonishing willingness on the part of the American people, very much egged on, as it were, by our political establishment, to simply keep trying with some vague hope or expectation that another 5 or 10 years of war or another 5 or 10 campaigns in another 5 or 10 countries is somehow going to yield a successful outcome at the other side. And there is no evidence to support that expectation.
Does ISIS scare you? Does the defeat of ISIS represent a worthy goal?
Of course it does. But no, ISIS does not scare me. ISIS represents an insignificant threat to the United States of America. It does represent an existential threat to the countries in the region. ISIS, this so-called caliphate, intends to erase the boundaries that have defined the nation states of that region. This is their problem. Now, the nation states in the region, to include Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, you name it, they are divided from one another on a host of issues. That notwithstanding, it is imperative for them to recognize that they have a transcendent interest in banding together to eliminate ISIS. That's their responsibility, and indeed the diplomatic task facing the United States is to get them to recognize that is their responsibility. And guess what? Were they to collaborate, they could dispose of ISIS without enormous difficulty.
But of course they can't.
No, they won't.
They won't.
They won't yet. And one of the reasons they won't is because we have developed a set of expectations that the problems of the Islamic world, the disorder and the dysfunction of the Islamic world, are our problems, and that our military can provide a solution to those problems. And there is no evidence to support that notion.
Can you take your historical perspective right now and, in hindsight, go back to 9/12/2001 and tell me honestly what you think militarily America should have done in response to 9/11?
I cannot claim to have had the insights on 9/12 that it would have enabled us to avoid the mess we've gotten ourselves into. But I can say that there were some people who did. I mean, in the immediate wake of 9/11, there were voices, ignored voices. There were voices that said, a global war on terrorism is an irrational undertaking, that terrorism cannot be destroyed, that the problem we have is one for which there is no military solution, that the solution will lie in an aggressive, well-resourced police campaign on an international scale to root out and destroy the entities that pose the terrorist threat. There were people who said that. I do not claim to have been one of them, but there were alternatives to the path that we have chosen to follow.
No end game? No end in sight? You really want to leave it with that?
Well, in the largest sense, the problem here is the challenges that some within the Islamic community have with reconciling faith with modernity. We in the West have found a way to find that reconciliation, that people who are believers can nonetheless live more or less comfortably in the modern world. Well, the Islamic world is going to have to find its own solution to that, and we can only assist on the margins, perhaps by, first of all, demonstrating that we are not their enemy, and secondly, by demonstrating by the way we live our lives that faith and modernity aren't at odds with one another.
Andrew Bacevich's latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball.
Vaughn into the windup in his first offering. Just a bit outside.
Mattingly, I thought I told you to trim those sideburns. Go home.
Oh, no, he's shaking off the signs. Big mistake.
Gets on base a lot, Rocco. Do I care if it's a walk or a hit?
You do not.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. An opening day for Major League Baseball this time next week. The season will be underway. One thing to watch for, home runs. During the 2015 season, there were about 700 more home runs than in 2014. Huh? What? Bad pitching? More steroids? GPS bats? Better baseballs? Neil Greenberg is a sports writer with The Washington Post, and he says that spring training seems to indicate that the big players are getting ready to swing the bats and have another strong season.
You can look at the Mets with Noah Syndergaard as having a strong spring. We're seeing some really good performances from the Washington Nationals. Obviously, the Chicago Cubs are the World Series favorite. They're playing up to the hype so far. I don't get too bogged down into what we're seeing in spring training, but so far there's been nothing, perhaps maybe with the exception of the Boston Red Sox sitting Pablo Sandoval and his huge contract. We're not seeing a lot of out-of-the-ordinary things just yet.
Are the hits going to continue this year, this season, like they did last season?
I think so. We saw something really strange last year, especially with the home run spike. For years, pitchers have had the upper hand, and there's been an increasing strike zone, so that's given them an edge as well. But there's been a change in scouting in some respects, looking for players, for batters especially, that have a different hitting plane and look to make more, not necessarily more contact, but just better contact.
But it looks to me like the quality of pitching is just reaching a kind of, you know, capacity.
What teams are looking for are pitchers who are special to games. Maybe they only need to pitch six innings. And they're really being encouraged to not save anything, right? To not leave anything on the field, to give it all they got, because they know that there's a bullpen that's also specialized in terms of middle relief and a closer that can come in with 98, 100-mile-an-hour fastballs and really put the cap on the game. And, you know, you also have to look at the injury factor. There's so many Tommy John surgeries. There's so much more injuries that are happening with pitchers that they need to be taken care of even more so than ever. And that, to me, is really the next frontier in terms of analytics and technological advances, is in the biometrics field. Keeping these pitchers on the field longer and keeping all players healthier and just making sure that you're getting your money's worth, because they're signing them to these million-dollar contracts, and it's really detrimental when they don't get on the field.
My feeling is, you know, in the era of performance-enhancing drugs, right, which is one issue, you've got these almost bionic arms. I mean, there's such a tendency to look to all kinds of very, very sophisticated surgical procedures to make these arms last as long as they possibly can. It seems like there's a collision there of who's a human and who's, you know, the bionic man.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said for a pitcher continually throwing 98, 99, 100 miles an hour. And, you know, quite frankly, the human body is just not made that way. It's not made to put up with that type of stress on a continual basis. And then you add in the torque on the elbow from breaking ball pitches, right, from curveball sliders. Pitchers are throwing harder, and they're throwing more pitches that put stress on the arm.
Finally, you mentioned the Nationals, the Mets, and the Cubs in the National League. I'm assuming the Cardinals will be strong and the Giants will probably be strong. What about the American League?
I think this is Houston Astros. The rebuild plan there has been ahead of schedule. They were able to beat the Yankees in the playoffs. I don't think necessarily many thought they would be a playoff team last year. They really look like they can take a step forward. It'll be interesting to see if Houston can actually make a deep playoff run, because then there's a lot of other teams in baseball that are rebuilding and may use them as a blueprint to show, especially ownership, that this doesn't need to be a long toil in last place. You can make some smart draft picks, make some smart moves, and then be back in contention within a couple of years.
Discount Moneyball.
Exactly.
Neil Greenberg is sports writer for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've been playing in these grungy mung holes waiting for our big break.
The numbers all go to 11.
I am a golden god!
Yeah! Cello.
Okay, this is a bass guitar, and it's the exact same thing, but instead of playing like this, you tip it on the side. Cello.
Movies on Friday with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. I wasn't familiar with any of those clips, except the end was...
That one
School
I don't
of Rock.
Know.
I think
oh,
School
that's
of
School
Rock.
Of Rock.
Cello, yes. Yeah,
I reckon
like
you didn't recognize Spinal Tap in there.
Yes, Spinal Tap. Right, 11. Going to 11, of course, also. We've got two movies, very different movies this weekend. Midnight Special is now going into wide release. Michael Shannon's in the movie. Let's hear a clip.
Why are you wearing those goggles, huh?
Stop! Stop! He's with me. He's my son.
Yeah, well, you ought to watch your kid.
Yeah, I got it. Thank you. You doing okay? You cannot leave the band. You hear me?
I'm sorry.
That vulnerable voice of Michael Shannon there, even with his tough, tough face. How is this movie?
Well, it's a science fiction thriller. Right. That's Jaden Lieberherr, who is the kid. He was in St. Vincent with Bill Murray. And he plays a kid who's got supernatural powers. The goggles he is wearing in that clip, they're for everyone's good, let's say. I don't want to spoil too much, because much of the fun of this film is trying to figure out what's happening with this kid. Why can he decode government satellites? Why can he why are those goggles on his eyes? And also, why is he wearing earmuffs all the time? And I think as the film unfolds, it's a lot of fun. It's very tense. It's very moody. Shannon's really great. Lieberherr is great. Adam Driver's in this. Kirsten Dunst, really good cast. I think if you're a sort of detail-oriented viewer, you might get a little bummed out by the ending. I don't think it quite works, but it's a fun ride.
Next film is Born to be Blue. We actually referred to this movie last week when we talked with Ethan Hawke and the director, Robert Boudreau. This is a biopic about Chet Baker, the jazz trumpeter.
I'm one of the greatest trumpet players of my generation. One of the best jazz improvisationalists.
So is trumpet or nothing?
Yes.
So maybe I should kill myself too. I don't look like Vivian Leigh.
You should find one thing and be better at it.
You know, that's easy for you to say. I'm blessed with a rare gift. Have some humility.
Jazz, heroin, alcohol, sex, tragedy.
Familiar
Ethan
story.
Hawke. Yes. What did you think?
That's Ethan Hawke as Chet Baker, and that's Carmen Ejogo as Jane, which is a fictionalized composite character, not based on a real person, although she's very good in that role.
Oh, my God. She's fantastic.
So you've seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this film, I think, gets off to kind of a rocky start. And it's a little bit flawed. It's a little bit rough around the edges. Although in a way that kind of matches Chet Baker's playing, and that matches his personality. And don't forget, he was a singer as well. And Ethan Hawke is really good in this role. I think that one of the highlights of the film is when he does a vocal rendition of My Funny Valentine, which was Chet Baker's signature song. It's a really chilling, beautiful moment in the film.
I thought Hawke's performance is so vulnerable and so carries this film. But the director made some interesting choices about time shifting. What did you think of those?
That didn't bother me so much. I mean, he has stated up front that this is a fictionalized version of things. You know, for instance, the way that Chet Baker loses his front teeth, this major turning point in his life, you know, that the details aren't quite, they don't quite match what actually happened in real life. I think it works, and I think it gives you a sense of what Chet Baker was trying to do in terms of battling drugs, if you can call it that, and also being true to his art and the way that he wanted to play music, which was not the healthiest way to play music.
Is there any studio executive who would have predicted that we would be sitting here talking about how Deadpool is a fantastic hit and that Batman versus Superman was kind of a flop?
Oh, boy, you've touched a nerve there. I hated Deadpool, and I hated Batman versus Superman.
But the bounce-back word of mouth on Batman versus Superman is actually pretty positive.
I know, surprisingly. You know, I got a ton of hate mail on my Batman versus Superman review, and then after the film came out, I got no hate mail. I thought that was because everyone realized that it was a terrible movie, but apparently there's repeat ticket sales.
Well, it's interesting how the reviewers and the consumers are very different constituencies. Well, you know, it's going to be rainy. Don't see any movies this weekend. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
I'm about to tell you a really important story in digital technology, but first, a metaphor. What if, in the middle of a friendly neighborhood game, it could be any game, a board game, blocks, pickup basketball, what if someone came along and just suddenly changed the rules? Forced you to do something you didn't want to and basically kicked you out of the game.
You're out!
What if you got so mad over this that you grabbed some elements of the game that you made and everyone was using and liberated them and just dropped out of sight? Suddenly, all the people playing the game start having problems. Uh-oh. This playground is headed for trouble. Now, this is not some silly, teachable moment in a preschool somewhere. This actually happened. And the consequences were a broken internet for long enough that it raises questions about the vulnerability of all of us dependent on digital technology and especially open source programming in the language JavaScript. Azar Kuchulu, a computer programmer who wrote some software he called Kik, got ordered to give up his name or be sued by a company that claims it owns the name Kik. Where did my freedom go? He asked. So instead of renaming his project, Azar simply took down what he had built, along with more than 250 other software modules he had authored, or as he said in a blog post, he liberated his modules.
There is like two definitions of hacker. Like, people break stuff, and they call themselves as hacker. And there is other kind of people like who build stuff. They build stuff, and they call themselves hacker as well. I'm on the side of building things, not breaking things.
For him, the principle of programmers working together, connected online and for free, the open source culture had been violated. And that freedom is very dear to him. And as you'll hear, his whole life has been shaped by this open source community. Azar Kuchulu came from Turkey to the United States to work as a programmer. And I asked him to explain the kind of freedom he claims he has found as an open source developer.
So I'm a self-taught engineer. I learn everything by just reading stuff online and building things by using free resources. I wouldn't say it's American freedom or other cultures' freedom. It's just freedom in internet. In real world, if we want to build something, we need means of production, which is expensive. Only rich people can build some stuff. But in internet, you just need time for building things. We have free resources. And these free resources are human resources. There are open source contributors all over the world. I'm one of them.
And so through this internet freedom, mm-hmm. you gained yeah. access to the United States in a way that millions of immigrants can't do.
Yeah, actually, I met an Iraqi immigrant in Turkey when I was trying to learn how to program, actually. He was illegal. He was doing programming for making his life because he didn't have a normal job, as he doesn't have work permit in Turkey. And I was like 16 years old or something. I met him online and he helped me a lot for learning programming. So it's a similar situation. Like, he came to Turkey from Iraq and he was doing programming for making his life, and now I do the same thing but in different country.
Now, you use the phrase, I'm liberating my modules.
Yeah.
That's kind of nice language. All right, is that what you are, a freedom fighter for software?
You know, I'm just a guy who's working for another private company and doing open source in the free time. But I'm aware of that. I owe my life to open source. I owe everything I have to the people who were like fighting for the rights of free software and open source. Although I'm working for private companies and I'm not a freedom fighter, I just wanted to make this decision. And I thought it's a simple decision, you know. I didn't know it's going to be a big deal.
What did you do as a response? You took these modules down, you liberated them. The reaction was, hey, all this software is screwed up. Did you, first of all, in hindsight, think that that was a smart idea, or was that maybe a little bit immature? Would you think about it maybe and do it differently if you had it to do again?
The first day, I didn't think about this at all because I was busy with other things. The second day, after like reconsidering everything, I mean, I was sorry for interrupting other people's work. You know, there is people out there like me working for another private company and their work is interrupted. So I was sorry for that. But on the other hand, once the system is fixed, we have lots of good conversations about the platform itself. So I'm happy that there is constructive, good conversation about how we can build another platform which is free and everyone is happy with that.
Eventually, will Facebook and Google and Snapchat and all these corporations control the internet and make it impossible for freelancers like you to do what you've done?
I believe open source community is going to be coming up with good solutions that will satisfy people. So I'm kind of positive about the future of the community. And I don't think that corporations will have a significant impact in the future of open source.
Azar Kuchulu is a computer programmer based in Oakland. Our journey with the writer and broadcaster Alvin Hall ends today as it began at his high school, the same school that had previously wiped away traces of his success as the first black valedictorian. It invited him back to celebrate his achievements. Put on your dancing shoes. It's Alvin Hall Day at Wakulla High School.
It's been a long, long time a-coming, but I know change gon' come. Oh, yes, indeed.
Wakulla County Proclamation declaring February 27th, 2016, as Alvin Hall Day. Mr. Alvin Hall, this is your day.
As that song said, it's been a long time coming. The last time I was on the stage was in 1970. I tried deliberately not to have any expectations. I tried not to do what I normally do, which would be to anticipate things. I thought it would be most beneficial for me to be completely and totally in the moment, to accept what things are, and then look back at my past experience here. This is very emotional for me. I know many people out there, and it's been sort of wonderful to come back and meet everybody. I did not anticipate that coming down here would open up all of this. I feel so lucky, having been born in a small town where you had to know everybody, you had to be nice to everybody whether you liked it or not. I am nice to people all around the world. The county is full of more people, specifically more white people have moved here. That's very clear. Religion seems even more deeply ingrained in the culture than when I was growing up, although that can't possibly be because I was raised very religiously. Church on Wednesday nights, Saturdays, Sundays all day. People always say to me, are you religious? I said, you can't have gone from church from the day you were born to the time you were 16 that many times and not be religious. It's impossible. But what I carry with me is a single, simple lesson. And that lesson is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. For people like Dot, who was always nice to me, Patricia, Francilla, for many of the people who were down here who were really supportive, it was like no time had passed. No time had passed. We could still talk. We could still laugh. We have great memories. Oh, especially with Francilla, because Francilla and I were really close, really close. I think probably closer than anybody else. Yeah, she means a lot to me. Yeah, I always get these points where I almost burst into tears because it's just touching to know. The other bit of generosity that I took from here was from Miss Freddie Grooms. Miss Grooms went to her friend, told him about me, and as a result, I got into Yale. Without those generosities, all which started here in Wakulla County, I'm not sure where I would be today. The thing that has been most surprising is how the people in my father's side of the family have attempted to embrace me in a way that they never did when I was growing up in Wakulla County. I'm the only son of my father and mother. Occasionally, I would look at myself in the mirror as I'm getting older and wonder, why is my face doing this? Why is my body doing this? Where does this come from? Because it clearly wasn't from my mother, so it had to be from my father. But I didn't have any of those reference points. I didn't know where my curiosity about the world, where my ambition, where my desire to travel came from. None of my other brothers and sisters with whom I were raised have this. None. And Tanya has been the link to all of that. And it's very touching for me. It's deeply emotional for me, much more so than I like to actually admit, because she's filling in all these gaps that I had decided many years ago to just let go. Why look back? Why look back? Would knowing it make my life today better? I think now it does make my life a little better. But unless somebody had brought that information to me, I would never have looked it up. When I left here, I left friends. I left teachers I loved. I left my sister, Linda, Andre, Rowena, Juan, who is dead, Sheila. I left my mother, my grandmother. I left everybody. And I went out on my own. And I knew from that day forward, it would be a journey, essentially, by myself. So I tell everybody, you leave a place. You don't know what the journey is going to be. But what you do know is that if you believe, if you take the good things that you gain from this small town and this small area, what you gain is a part of yourself that you can keep, and it will hold you strong through the vicissitudes of life. So wherever I go, there's part of Wakulla County that is going with me, and each and every one of you share in that. So thank you very much for having me back after all this time. I sincerely appreciate it. Thank you. I think they all have, in a funny way, been waiting for me to come home. I think they all think that I'm going to come home. And I know I'm not. I am very glad to have this opportunity to come back. And I will come back again. But I couldn't come and live back here again. I couldn't. It would be the death of me. In many ways, the world out there knows the new me, and the people here know the old me. And I don't think they have synthesized those two yet. I don't think they have to. As long as they know Donnell Hall, that's fine. And I'm very happy to be Donnell Hall. I don't disown that name. But I know that when I went to Yale, I became Alvin Hall. And that started the journey of Alvin. All I ever wanted to be was a writer. I really didn't want to be much else, but I had to make a living in life. And maybe at this point, all of this is coming to me so that I can do the one thing I wanted to do when I was 8 and 9 years old. I've already started thinking about, when I get back to New York City, how I'm going to block out time just to revisit all of this and take notes and decide where I'm going. Clearly, it has to be Alvin Hall Day. I think that's just the entry point. It just has to be that. But to come down here to see where I am from and to see this part of the world, which is, I think, is unimaginable to most people. I think most people who know me would never imagine that this is the world in which I grew up.
Our thanks to Alvin Hall for letting us come along on his journey. Thanks to the Takeaway's fearless leader, Rupert Allman, for convincing him. Thanks to Dana Roberson and Vince Fairchild for producing our series. The entire Alvin Hall Return to Wakulla series can be found at our website, thetakeaway.org/Alvin Hall. And here's something to take with you on this very happy Alvin Hall Day. Other firsts who were honored that evening included the first integrated class at Wakulla High and the Shadeville Four, the four white students who were sent to the all-black high school. In nearly 50 years, the outside world that Alvin so wanted to escape to as a young boy has found its way into Wakulla County. This school year, the district hired Simeon Nelson, the first black principal in Wakulla County since integration. And the current principal of Wakulla High School, Mike Barwick, who's white. He attended Florida A&M University, a historically black university in Tallahassee. It was Barwick who re-energized the school's annual Black History Celebration, including Alvin Hall Day. You can listen to all of Alvin Hall's stories at thetakeaway.org/Alvin Hall. We also have a video of a performance by pianist Marco Benevento on our website, thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.